From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. TV's most popular cartoon family celebrates an anniversary this weekend, the 300th episode of The Simpsons. On today's Fresh Air, an inside look at the series with creator Matt Groening. We'll also hear from Simpsons producers Al Jean and Mike Reese. We meet Alf Clausen, the music director of The Simpsons, and some actors who bring the drawings to life. Julie Kavner is the voice of Marge Simpson, and Harry Shearer does a number of characters, including Mr. Burns and Smithers. Also, film critic John Powers reviews The Quiet American, starring Michael Caine. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell says there's still a chance of peace in the Persian Gulf, but the UN Security Council must maintain the threat of military force against Iraq. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Baradei say Iraq has shown more signs of cooperation since their last report to the Council on January 27th. But Secretary of State Powell noted that even the inspectors say that Iraq still is not doing enough.
Both inspectors at the end of their statements indicated clearly that they have not yet seen the kind of level of cooperation that would bring this matter to a conclusion.
But France, Russia, and China say the inspectors are making progress and should be given more time. France is calling for a Security Council foreign ministers meeting on March 14th to hear from the inspectors again. Powell says no decision has been made on that. He says council representatives need to go back to their capitals for consultation. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, New York.
Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge said today that the nation remains on high alert for another possible terrorist attack, but he cautioned against overreacting to the warning. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
4 days after people started to buy large amounts of water, food, duct tape, and plastic sheeting in response to government advice, Ridge called for some calm and common sense, especially about the use of duct tape.
We do not want individuals or families to start sealing their doors or their windows. It is very appropriately listed in the list of supplies for an emergency supply kit.
He said it can be effective on some occasions, but anti-terrorism experts note that sealing rooms from possible chemical attacks can have limited value and that it cuts off the air supply after a short time. Ridge said his department will launch an extensive public awareness campaign next week on how best to respond to different types of attacks. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut criticized the administration's preparations for homeland defense, saying that much remains to be done. The Democratic presidential hopeful said U.S. borders and ports are still too loosely guarded, infrastructure is underprotected, and the nation's supply of antidotes and vaccines is too limited.
At a minimum, to meet our most urgent homeland security needs, we need to invest at least $16 billion more than the president proposes for our homeland security next year, including $7.5 billion more than the president wants for our first responders.
Lieberman spoke today at George Washington University in the nation's capital. In stocks today, the Dow gained 159 points to close at 7,908 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 32 points to close at 1310. This is NPR News. The prospect of a war against Iraq is drawing hundreds of thousands of anti-war protesters in Europe and other parts of the world. Peace activists in London are hoping to marshal 500,000 people for a demonstration tomorrow in Hyde Park. About 150,000 people marched against the war today in Melbourne, Australia. The NASA official in charge during the final moments of Space Shuttle Columbia says a breach in the spacecraft's heat shield could have led to the accident, though no firm cause has been established. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
Lead reentry flight director Leroy Kane was in charge of mission control when sensor data started arriving about problems aboard Space Shuttle Columbia. Temperatures in the left landing gear wheel well and the left wing began rising before the shuttle broke apart. Kane agrees with NASA engineers that super-hot gases leaking past the shuttle's heat shield during the fiery re-entry into Earth's atmosphere could account for the higher temperatures and the loss of the shuttle. However, Kane says that scenario has not been proven.
I don't believe that we've zeroed in on by any means, on the fact that we suffered a breach. I think there's many legs of the fault tree that we still need to consider.
A fault tree is a NASA phrase for all possibilities that could have led to the loss of the shuttle. Kane also thinks useful data may come from the last 32 seconds of information beamed to Earth from Columbia. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
The first cloned mammal has been put to death. Scientists in Scotland say that Dolly the sheep was given a lethal injection after contracting a fatal lung infection. Dolly was 6 years old. Sheep of her breed can live to be 11 or 12. Scientists say her death appears to be unrelated to cloning. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross.
I can't count how many times your father's done something crazy like this.
It's 300, Mom.
This Sunday, Fox presents the 300th episode of The Simpsons. It's not only the longest-running animated series in primetime TV history, it's one of the longest-running, period. In fact, it's about to pass The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, which lasted 14 seasons, as the longest-running sitcom ever. Ozzie and Harriet wasn't a cartoon, but it wasn't funny either. The Simpsons was, and still is.
Bart, you're suing us?
Yes, I want to be emancipated.
Emancipated? Don't you like being a dude?
No, Dad. It means Bart would be a legal adult and free to move out of the house.
I wanted a sewing room, but not like this. Not like this.
Mom, you've always been cool to me. But Homer is a lousy dad, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Hey, my dad was lousy, and I didn't sue him. I just dumped him in the cheapest home I could find.
Matt Groening created the cartoon characters of The Simpsons 14 years ago as short features for The Tracey Ullman Show, and spun them off into their own series in 1990. I spoke to Groening in 1998, right before the broadcast of The Simpsons' 200th episode, and asked how The Simpsons compared to other American families.
I think one of the things about The Simpsons is that it really is about the anxiety and consternation of living with people who drive you out of your mind. Because it's animation and because it's a comedy, we do a lot of foreshortening, a lot of slight exaggeration. I call it rubber band reality. That is, it's real, and then we stretch it out for a moment, and then it snaps back to reality. But it is about the things that drive you crazy. I mean, how do you live with people you love and you want to kill? I think that's the underlying theme of The Simpsons. And in the midst of all that, it's a celebration of that idea. That is, at the end of the day, it's not a Beckett play. It's a cartoon.
The amazing thing about The Simpsons is that it's been going on for like 172 years now, and it is still consistently entertaining week in and week out, year in and year out, in a way that most TV series that last that long are not. You guys don't seem to slump.
I think one of the reasons why The Simpsons has sustained its velocity is that each new group of animators and writers who comes on board tries to top the previous group. And we have a bunch of really talented people who are trying to cram as many jokes and observations as they can into every episode. And one thing I'm very proud of The Simpsons is that we don't have a laugh track, unlike every other sitcom on TV, although I don't think a laugh track would work anyway in animation. But anyway, we don't have one, so we get more jokes than usual in our shows. So I'm happy.
Now, with all of the new people coming in, that means old people are going out. It used to be in the late 70s and early 80s that MTM Productions was the place where people would go to learn TV and go out. And, of course, one of your partners, Jim Brooks, was one of the co-founders there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you can look back at the people that you have lost to other venues over the years for The Simpsons and point out who's doing what where now.
Well, let's see. Greg Daniels went from The Simpsons to King of the Hill and co-created that with Mike Judge. And the rest have disappeared into total obscurity. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. Conan O'Brien went on to some success.
Yeah, near total obscurity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's really fun to see Conan. And also, you know, on the internet, we get lots of fan comments, and we read them and are thoroughly annoyed by them. Thank you very much. But our fans are very critical. And the one of the annoying note posts is the idea that the show really hasn't been the same since Conan has been gone, and if we can only get Conan back. So we're trying. We're trying to get Conan back. But
tell me more about how Jim Brooks and you hooked up in the first place. What was it that you think that he saw in you that made it a good pairing?
Well, Jim was working with a producer named Polly Platt, who liked my cartoon strip Life in Hell, which was running in the Los Angeles Reader at the time, a local weekly paper. And they called me up, and they said they had were doing this new comedy variety show, and they wanted to have little animated cartoons as part of the show, and suggested that I animate my Life in Hell characters, which I thought was a great idea. I found out that I would give up ownership of whatever it is that I put up, and so I created The Simpsons in their stead, because, you know, Life in Hell with my rabbits and Akbar and Jeff, that's a regular gig, and I was doing just fine with that, and I didn't know if this animation thing was going to pan out at all. And I decided not to sacrifice my own characters, so I made up these other characters I didn't really care about. The Simpsons. And they were, you know, in the back of my mind, I really wanted to, you know, do this thing as a TV series. I thought it should be a TV series. And so it was inspired by both memories of my own family and in the family sitcoms that I was glued to when I was a kid. Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet in particular were really important to me as a kid. You know, Ozzie and Harriet, everybody thinks, oh, Ozzie and Harriet. It's like this sort of symbol for blandness. And it was kind of corny and bland, but it was also really surreal. And I'm telling you, watch those reruns. They used to run them on the Disney Channel. I don't know where they are now, but they're fantastic, really. The good ones, the early ones. Not when Ricky and Dave got married, it wasn't as good, but when when they were still going through adolescence, it was really a cool show.
Tell me a little bit about Matt Groening at home when you're not at The Simpsons. How do you and your kids react to TV now? What life do you have when you're not working?
Well, I have two sons, aged 9 and 6, and they're huge fans of the show, and we have tapes of The Simpsons. And when I get up in the morning and come down to breakfast, they're usually watching the show. And I, you know, I'm not in the best of mood before I've had my coffee, and so I tell them to shut it off, and they now think that I hate The Simpsons because I don't want to hear it before I, you know, wake up in the morning. I don't like to be woken up to the sound of Bart. Also, another thing is, you know, and I'll take this opportunity to apologize to America. You know, there was a lot of complaints about Bart and what a brat he was and a bad example for kids. And I thought, oh, come on, grow up. Stop acting like Homer Simpson and your kids won't act like Bart Simpson. But the fact is, now that I have these kids and they're quoting the show back to me, it is really annoying. I mean, we did on The Simpsons. We did, you know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet in the car? My kids still, years later, they still think that's funny.
What were some of the things that warped you early as a teenager? I know that Rocky and Bullwinkle had to be a big influence.
I loved Rocky and Bullwinkle. I've said this before. Jay Ward and Bill Scott, who did that, were my heroes. Because here was bad animation. I mean, let's face it, Rocky and Bullwinkle is pretty flimsy looking. But it had great writing, and it had great voices, and it had great music. And I thought, boy, if you could get something like that on the air again, it'd be really fun to do. And that was one of my goals in life, and, you know.
It's one of the animated rules that I remember you mentioning is that The Simpsons will never cross their eyes And I don't know if that goes for the other characters in the show as well, but it's just one thing that you just didn't want to have your characters do.
Oh, yeah, stylistically, there's a few rules on The Simpsons. That's one of them, that they don't go cross-eyed for gag effect. Like, if you clonk them on the head, they don't go cross-eyed, and stars don't go above their heads, and little birds fly around or anything like that. Generally, when The Simpsons fall off the cliff, the unrealistic thing is that they survive, but the realistic thing is that they're, you know, battered and bloody. You know, so I think we're one of the first cartoons to actually show blood. You know, I think even in the Tom and Jerry cartoons and some of the other very violent cat and mouse cartoons, there was no blood, but there's blood on The Simpsons,
and certainly on Itchy. And
you know, I'm proud of that too, because I don't know why.
Well, what are some of the other rules that you decided on at the very beginning when you were first?
Well,
doing
as far as eyeballs go, basically the characters look straight ahead or they go slightly wall-eyed to convey alienation. They don't have that one eye up and one pupil up, one pupil down look, you know, for craziness too. What are some of the other rules? Just as far as sound effects, no boings, no boing, you know, when they get hit. All the sound effects are relatively realistic. I mean, you know, when Homer falls over and you know, cracks his back against a fire hydrant, it's a celery crunch, but it could be a spine.
Now,
it's not a boing. You know, it's not a Three Stooges sound effect.
But with sound effects, is it true that you originally provided the sound effect that you did the sucking for Maggie on the pacifier?
Well, on the pacifier, yeah. Well, yes, I did.
And have you now turned that duty over to a pacifier specialist?
No, I think through the miracle of modern technology, as far as I know, it's still the same suck. It's they only had to do it once, and then they just keep repeating it. You know, that's how it goes.
Wow.
That's just my tongue against my lower lip.
What do you have about keeping Bart, especially at that exact age in school?
You know, one of the great things about animation is that your actors don't get old and decrepit. You know, they don't rob stores. They don't they don't have tragic rehab stories. You know, anything like that. They just stay the way you draw them. And I think it's one of the fun things we have with The Simpsons is that Bart has turned 10 so many times. And, you know, we've talked about aging them. When this actor's strike happened on the show, there was one suggestion from a Fox executive to, why don't you just age the characters and then have different voices? That's a solution. We thought that was not such a good
idea. That's scary. Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're paying tribute to The Simpsons, which will broadcast its 300th episode this weekend.
Dear purveyors of senseless violence, I know this may sound silly at first, but I believe that the cartoons you show to our children are influencing their behavior in a negative way. Please try to tone down the psychotic violence in your otherwise fine programming. Yours truly, Marge Simpson.
Take a letter, Miss White. Dear valued viewer, thank you for taking an interest in the Itchy and Scratchy program. Enclosed is a personally autographed photo of America's favorite cat and mouse team to add to your collection. In regards to your specific comments about the show, our research indicates that one person cannot make a difference, no matter how big a screwball she is. So let me close by saying...
And the horse I rode in on, I'll show them what one screwball can do.
That was from one of my favorite episodes of The Simpsons, in which Marge campaigns against cartoon violence. We're going to hear from two of the original writers of The Simpsons, Al Jean and Michael Reese. They've also written for The Tonight Show, It's Gary Shandling Show, and Sledgehammer.
They've been partners since their college days at Harvard. One of their Simpsons episodes, in which Marge takes a stand against the blood and gore and the itchy and scratchy cartoons her children watch, is a favorite around here. In 1992, Terry Gross asked Gene and Reese how and why they wrote it.
The cartoons that they watched on The Simpsons, the Itchy and Scratchy show, were extremely violent, so she led a crusade and actually got them to tone down their violence. And the cartoons were really pathetic without violence. They were really lame. So kids didn't watch them, and then they went out and they started, riding bikes and building things and having fun. And, it seemed like a golden age, but then Michelangelo's David was going to tour Springfield, and then the same people that wanted to censor the cartoons wanted to put pants on the statue, and Marge realized that you can't really censor one thing without saying that censorship is okay in all forms. For a children's show, or so, quote-unquote children's show, it really had a lot to say.
It's sort of typical of a Simpsons episode, which is it made a lot of points that all canceled each other out. The show really doesn't have a platform.
The other thing is we're sort of crusading against violent cartoons, but of course we got to show about 10 minutes of very violent cartoons, so we were kind of playing both ends against the middle.
Well, the violent cartoons that you show are Itchy and Scratchy, which kind of regularly appear in the series. And, all they do is just kind of, like, beat on each other with a hammer. I mean, that's the whole, there is no plot, or there's not even as much plot as there is in a Roadrunner cartoon.
They average about 6 seconds long. So if it was a real cartoon, you really wouldn't, get much out of them.
We generally even spend longer writing the title of the cartoon than writing the rest of it. Something like Bang the Cat Slowly. was one title, and that took about 2 hours, and the rest of the cartoon was pretty easy to do.
Now, how do you work with the animators? Do you write the scripts first and then hand it over to them?
Yeah, the first thing we do is write the script and then record the audio track with the cast.
We record it like a radio show. It takes about 8 hours, and we cut it down to about 19 minutes of audio track. And then that's sent to the animators, who expand it to about 24 minutes.
We have a team of 6 guys who are terrific. They direct the way a movie director directs a feature. And, they take the script and they pretty much stage the whole thing, design the characters. And then we see a real rough version in black and white called an animatic. We do some rewrites there. And then we send the whole thing to Korea. And that's where the actual color animation is done. It comes back about 3 months later.
You're really working far ahead.
It's sort of a good thing, which is, We throw in some topical allusions, but I think it's going to make the show a little more, it'll be a little timeless because we can't ride every current thing and get a quick laugh off of something that's in the news right now.
A bad thing that happens is we'll use a name like Rex Harrison or somebody, and then he'll die before the show airs, so we have to change it. It's sort of like there's a curse. And then we did a big joke about the Soviet Union and it died. So we have to just kind of be careful.
We had a little thing where Jackie Mason appeared on the show, and they flew to New York to record him, and he just made some reference to Isaac Bashevis Singer. And then a couple of months later, reading the paper, Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Oh, no. And we had to fly back to New York and get him to replace the line with Saul Bellow. And then for the next 2 months, we were praying, Saul Bellow, please don't die. And, these prayers were going out to him, and I think he didn't know why.
are there aspects of your family life that you've ever written into an episode?
Since we work on the show all the time, there, is maybe 1 hour's worth of family life a week, but we do suck that into the show. I mean, we do draw from anything that happens to us.
Yeah, it's because we can pour everything into the show. I think it does draw on everybody's childhood. We've really sucked everyone dry at the show. And what I'm actually curious to see this coming season, I've thrown a lot of my family's traumas into the show, and I haven't told them, and I'm going to see if they recognize them and if they get mad at me.
Can I ask you to give an example of something that happened in your lives, either as children or as adults, in your family, that you've used on an episode?
A little one would be when we were kids, my dad would want us to say grace, and my sister would go, rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, and he'd get really mad. So we put that in an episode with Bart. Let's see.
There's one coming up next season where Homer wants Bart to have a nice bed, and so he builds these clown beds for him that have a big clown head on the front and big feet at the foot of the bed. And the premise is you're supposed to be happy because you're sleeping in a clown's guts. And Homer paints this very grotesque clown face on the clown, and it gives Bart nightmares, and he's very scared, and he wants to stay as far from the beds as possible. And this is something that actually my father did when I was a kid.
He made a bed like that for you?
He made a clown bed, and it was, the face was so creepy. It had these dark, sunken eyes and big, black, flaring nostrils that the kids finally sawed the heads off the clowns and stuck them in the closet with the faces facing the back wall.
As professional comedy writers, do you quip a lot around the house, like characters in sitcoms always do?
At home, it's more like, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, well, there's the baby. I better go say hello. We do have a lot of laughs around the office, but it's never about the script.
Yeah.
The fun stuff is always just talking about, you know, the elections or, you know, things that when we're wasting time and we're not, you know, doing things that are connected with the show, that's fun.
It's really as funny as it gets. It'll be rolling and everyone's laughing, and then someone's got to say, well, let's get back to those damn Simpsons.
Al Jean and Mike Reese were two of the original writers for The Simpsons. The Simpsons' 300th episode will be broadcast this Sunday. More Simpsons in the second half of our show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Smithers, Turn on the surveillance monitors.
Yes, sir.
It's worse than I thought. Each morning at 9, they trickle through the gate. They go home early. They come in late. Reeking of cheap liquor, they stumble through the day. Never give a thought to honest work for honest pay. I know it shouldn't vex me. I shouldn't take it hard. I should ignore their capering with a kingly disregard. But look at all those idiots. Oh, look at all those boobs. An office full of morons. A factory full of fools. Is it any wonder that I'm singing the blues?
Yours is a heavy burden, sir.
I'm just getting started. They make personal phone calls on company time. They Xerox their buttockses and guess who pays the dime? Their blatant thievery wounds me. Their ingratitude astounds. I long to lure them to my home and then release the hounds. I shouldn't grow unsettled when faced with such abuse. I shouldn't let it plague me. I shouldn't blow a fuse. But look at all those idiots. Oh, look at all those boobs. An office full of morons. A factory full of fools. Is it any wonder I'm singing the blues? What happened? Where are the instruments?
I believe they call this breakdown, sir.
I can't have any breakdowns here. What if there was an
major funding
around?
For Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble booksellers, and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for Lovers, The Couple's Guide to Finding Happiness One Movie at a Time, by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, doing the Bart Man. We meet Alf Clausen, the composer of such tunes as Ion Springfield and Who Needs the Quickie Mart. Also, Julie Kavner and Harry Shearer talk about doing the voices of Marge Simpson and Mr. Burns. And movie critic John Powers reviews The Quiet American. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. We're spending the hour celebrating The Simpsons, an amazingly consistent and entertaining cartoon series marking its 300th episode this weekend. Because it's an animated show, there are elements of The Simpsons that don't get the respect they deserve. The acting is inspired. The dialogue is right on the money. And the music is, in a word, delightful. Here's The Simpsons' musical version of A Streetcar Named Desire.
Stella! Stella! Can't you hear me, Ella? You're putting me through hell, Stella! Stella!
Many of The Simpsons song parodies are collected on the CDs Songs in the Key of Springfield and Go Simpsonic with The Simpsons. You can listen to these gems over and over again because the lyrics are as clever as the arrangements.
Whoever you are, I have always depended on the kindness of strangers.
You can always depend on the kindness of strangers.
Now here's a tip from Bert you won't regret.
Alf Clausen composes and arranges most of the music on The Simpsons. He was also the composer for the TV series Moonlighting, The Donnie and Marie Show, and Mary Tyler Moore's Variety Hour. In 1997, Terry asked him how he works with The Simpsons writers who come up with the lyrics.
Very closely. It's a collaborative effort in creating the songs. I'm usually given a set of script pages that contain the lyric, and I'm usually given enough pages in front of the lyric and behind the lyric so that I know what the setup of the scene is supposed to be. And once I'm given the lyric, I'll be in conference with the producers, and I'll get a scan from them as to the pacing of the lyric, what the intent of the scene is, what the ambiance of the song should be.
Let me move to another track on The Simpsons' Songs in the Key of Springfield CD. And you wrote a theme for the Springfield new show, Eye on Springfield, with Kent Brockman.
Right.
Tell me about writing this theme and what you think of TV themes and news themes that you hear.
I think that my take on TV news themes in general now is that somewhere along the way there has been a god of rock and roll that has reached down and grabbed every news director by the neck and said, our news theme must contain rock and roll, and our news theme must be synthesized, because that's what the public relates to now. It gives us all this excitement, and that's what I tried to reach for in the Eye on Springfield theme. The rock groove plus the electronic synthesized music that everybody's come to know and love.
Well, let's hear your version of this, the Eye on Springfield theme with Kent Brockman.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Springfield.
Infotainment.
What are some of the for real TV themes that you've written over the years?
Well, TV themes has not been my bailiwick, as they say. I co-wrote the theme to the Elf series, and other than that, I have been basically known as an underscore music person, not a theme writer.
I want to get to another song on the Simpsons CD, and this is actually a parody of a song from Schoolhouse Rock, the song I'm Just a Bill on Capitol Hill. And this was a song written by Dave Frischberg that does describe how a bill becomes a law.
And this is a really clever parody of that by a demagogue, you know, sung in the persona of a demagogue. And Jack Sheldon, who the trumpeter who sang the original version, sings this one as well. Tell us how this one came about.
Well, again, the lyric originated as part of the script, and when I was given the sample that this was supposed to follow, when I heard the original, my first comment was, well, that's Jack Sheldon singing. And the producer said, do you know him? And I said, oh, yes, he's a friend of mine. He's worked for me many times in the past. He worked for me on Moonlighting, playing some of his beautiful, beautiful trumpet solos. He's one of the best jazz trumpet players in the world. And I said, wouldn't it be funny if we could get Jack to sing on our parody as well as the original? And the comment was made of, do you think we'd be able to get him? And I said, sure, let me make the call. I called Jack, and Jack said, I'd be glad to do this. So it really, I think, makes it come that much closer to home and gives the bite that much more significance.
What did you have to do musically to make it not exactly what the original song is? I mean, Dave Frischberg, who wrote the original, probably wasn't going to sue you, but is that the kind of thing you have to worry about?
It's an interesting challenge. By the way, Dave's an old friend of mine. He and I used to play casuals together when I was still playing.
Casuals?
And before he... casuals. You know, weddings, dances, and stuff like that. I was a bass player. He's a piano player, and we played some jobs together before he moved to New York and became a famous songwriter. It's always an interesting challenge to try to walk the line of creating an homage to someone, but not duplicating it note for note. So obviously, I'm always concerned about the fact that what I want to do is original, but nevertheless brings back the ambiance of the selected parody piece. It's tricky, but I think we got it to work.
Well, let's hear the parody of I'm Just a Bill. The parody is called The Amendment Song, and this is from an episode of The Simpsons called The Day the Violence Died.
Hey, who left all this garbage on the steps of Congress?
I'm not garbage. I'm an amendment to be. Yes, an amendment to be. And I'm hoping that they'll ratify me. There's a lot of flag burners who have got too much freedom. I wanna make it legal for policemen to beat them, cause there's limits to our liberties. At least I hope and pray that there are, cause those liberal freaks go too far.
But why can't we just make a law against flag burning?
Because that law would be unconstitutional. But if we change the Constitution,
then we can make all sorts of crazy laws.
Now you're catching on.
What the hell is this?
It's one of those campy 70s throwbacks that appeals to Generation Xers.
We need another Vietnam to thin out their ranks a little.
What if people say you're not good enough to be in the Constitution?
Then I'll crush all opposition to me, and I'll make Ted Kennedy pay. If he fights back, I'll say that he's gay.
Amendment, they ratified ya. You're in the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, yeah. Doors open, boys.
When you're writing a song parody, you're trying to write it as if it were serious, as if it were really a Broadway show or really a movie theme.
Absolutely. Not only in creating the songs, but in creating the underscore music for The Simpsons and trying to give credence to the emotional content of what the characters are saying, I'm always extremely serious. And I think what happens is that the listener and observer gets pulled into the situation more effectively once the music is serious, so that when the gag finally comes, the gag then becomes twice as funny.
Alf Clausen, music director of The Simpsons. We'll be back after a break with two of the voices from The Simpsons. This is Fresh Air.
Julie Kavner has a wonderful comic voice. It was perfect for the part of the neurotic, insecure sister on Rhoda, the TV series that launched Kavner's career, and for lots of characters on The Tracy Ullman Show, where she first introduced and developed the voice of Marge Simpson. Terry spoke with her in 1994.
The Simpsons originated on The Tracy Ullman Show.
Right.
And that's when you were first asked to play Marge Simpson. Mm-hmm. What was your first reaction to the concept of being the voice of Marge?
It was, you know, the very, very beginning of the process of figuring out what the show should be. And it was just one more thing that we were asked to do that we had never done, or that I had never done before. And it was a wonderful cartoon and a wonderful family from the mind of Matt Groening. It was based on his vision of himself in his family. And it was, so it was terrific to begin with. And that voice came out of, before I took this wonderful year of singing lessons, I had very, very tired voice, and I just raised it a little bit and said, how about this for Marge? And they said, okay.
So how do you change your voice to become Marge?
I roughen it up and I raise it a bit. I raise it an octave or so.
Can you do a little
more? Well, it's just kind of up there like that and a little more tired.
Right. Now, does it hurt your voice to do that?
Not at all. The sisters, on the other hand, the two twin sisters, are an octave lower. Do I have a range or what, Terry?
You want to do one of the sisters?
Well, they happen to be my favorites.
Oh, that's great. You have a wonderful voice. Was your voice husky when you were young?
Yeah, I was born this way. I came out of my mom and said, hello, Rose. Hello, Dave.
But did you have a deep voice when you were young?
Yeah, they used to send me home. They always used to think I had laryngitis.
Oh, the nurses? Or...
Mm-hmm.
You have a very New York voice, but you grew up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Rose and Dave, who I just mentioned to you, my
parents,
they're from New York, and they taught me how to speak English. You see, so that's why I sound like this, as opposed to something lovely.
Julie Kavner does the voice of Marge Simpson.
There are several fine young men who I'm sure are gonna go far. Ladies and gentlemen, the Ramones.
Ah, these minstrels will soothe my jangled nerves.
I'd just like to say this gig sucks.
Hey, up yours, Springfield.
1, 2, 3, 4...
Hell, you old bastard.
Hey, I think they liked us.
Have the Rolling Stones killed.
Oh, sir, those aren't...
Do as I say.
Many of the voices on The Simpsons come from the mouth of actor and satirist Harry Shearer. He's the voice of Mr. Burns, Smithers, Principal Skinner, Ned Flanders, Kent Brockman, and numerous other characters. You've probably heard him caricature the voices of our political leaders in his political satires on his own radio program, Les Show, which recently celebrated its 20th anniversary. Shearer is also known for playing bass player Derek Smalls in Spinal Tap, the ultimate parody of a heavy metal band. He's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and got started in showbiz as a child actor. In 1993, Terry spoke with Harry Shearer about his earliest days in showbiz. When he was 9, he performed on Jack Benny's radio show, doing the voice of Jack Benny as a child.
Was Jack Benny nice to you?
He was the greatest. I did his show a lot. After the third time I did his radio show, he came out into the hallway behind the studio after the show was over, gave me this huge hug, and gave me a transcription of the show that we just finished. And it was just, from then on, it was he was so warm and kind to me. He was very generous, very smart, very generous in the sense of liking the fact, not just allowing the people around him to get laughs, but really liking the fact that the supporting players on his program got laughs. I remember vividly the first time I made him laugh in a rehearsal. We were reading the script and sitting around a table, and I ad-libbed a little thing. And I mean, I was a kid. I was, you know, 8 or 9 years old, and to see Jack Benny not just laugh, but, I mean, laugh uproariously and hit the table was so amazing.
What did you say? I mean, what did you say that got him laughing?
I was playing, the Beverly Hills Beavers were doing their version of Jack Benny's radio show, so I was playing Sheldon Leonard, the guy who played the racetrack. Hey, bud, come here a minute. I got to hit the... I forget exactly what I said. It may have just been something I did with my voice. I don't know. But, I mean, I remember I did a little something, and all of a sudden Jack Benny is, like, hitting, you know, pounding the table laughing. It was easy for him to be generous in giving the supporting players around him laughs because he always knew he could get a great laugh by reacting to them. That said, a lot of people in show business, a lot of people in comedy, aren't that smart to know that they can always get a good laugh by reacting and get very jealous of people around them getting any laughs at all. He was also one of the first people I knew who owned his own show.
Oh.
Very smart guy.
One thing I always loved about Jack Benny, one of the many things, is that he could just make that, you know, that little, like, annoyed smirk that he'd have when he'd hold his two fingers up to his chin, and he'd just roll his eyes a little and look away. He'd get so much out of that one gesture.
Yeah.
Did that give you ideas when you were young and watching him?
What gave me, you know, what really inspired me was watching him have this character that, if you analyzed his character, or any of the great comic characters, but let's take Benny. You know, he was a miser, he was vain, he was a bad employer, he was all these comically unpleasant things, and yet he was beloved. And, you know, you flash forward to the recent past, and television executives particularly, and also movie executives, have had the idea that comic characters had to be, quote, likable. That is to say, they had to be characters composed of likable characteristics. Well, likable characteristics aren't funny, which is why you have characters in sitcoms with no definable character just trading wisecracks with each other, because there's nothing funny about the characters. That's all been shaved off. Benny showed, you know, marvelously well how lovable you can be being not lovable.
Now, I have a friend who recently saw you on the pilot, he thinks it was, or the first episode of Leave It to Beaver.
It was the pilot.
The pilot.
Mm-hmm.
What did you play?
Eddie Haskell.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You were Eddie Haskell?
Yeah.
Oh, he told me you were Eddie Haskell's friend. Oh, you were Eddie Haskell. You were the obnoxious friend.
Yeah.
What happened? You didn't get the part?
My parents took the position that it was fine for me to work on TV and radio as a child, but they didn't want me being in a series. I think their reasoning was that it would take me out of school. I was going to, like, regular public school, and then when I'd get a job, I'd go work and come back to school. If you're in a series, you're just in that world forever. You know, you never go back to public school, and you're on the set all the time. I now realize later, with the hindsight that I've accumulated in show business, that it's also not a good idea for a 9 or 10-year-old kid to have, you know, 200 guys on the crew standing around going, kid looks off this week. You know, their paycheck is dependent on a 9-year-old and the pressure of those guys watching him. Kids losing the cuteness a little bit here. What's happening? You know, you don't want that. So I'm very glad that happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were on GE Theater, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the one Ronald Reagan hosted?
Yeah, it sure was. mm-hmm. During it was, he'd not only host it, but he'd go out to the GE plants all over the country and do the thing with the light bulb and such.
did you meet him?
No.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, what a shame. He came in and did all his stuff, you know, at one time. You know, he'd host 20 shows at a crack and then go off and do his touring of the...
do the hello and say the fellas, you're making good light bulbs, keep it up. You know, do that.
Oh, gee, I'm so disappointed that you didn't meet him. You could have, you know, you could have started studying him at an early age.
You can't study people at an early age. I have a very distinct memory of being on the radio with partners of mine and talking about the people who were difficult to do. And at the time, Reagan was governor of California, and we agreed that he was one of the most difficult people to do. But as public figures get older, possibly because they learn what it is that works and keep doing that, they increasingly become caricatures of themselves, and so they save you the effort. You don't have to caricature them. You just do them. And he became incredibly easy to do as time went on. I think that that's, you know, that they all have handlers and advisors who tell them, do this. This is what works. And that's what sort of makes them narrower and narrower, narrower and narrower as people and easier to do as a result.
Harry Shearer, recorded in 1993.
Don't worry. I brought my Rappin' Ronnie Reagan tape. It always makes the trip go faster.
Well.
You know something? He did say well a lot.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film, The Quiet American. This is Fresh Air. Michael Caine received an Academy Award nomination for his starring role in The Quiet American, adapted from the novel by Graham Greene. Caine plays a veteran British journalist living in Saigon before the start of the Vietnam War. Brendan Fraser co-stars. Film critic John Powers has this review.
A couple of years ago in Ho Chi Minh City, I was heading up Dong Khoi, the legendary downtown street that, like a happy love affair, begins at a hotel and ends at a church. A six-year-old boy followed me, crying, "You Wong Grand Gri, Quai American, Quai American." I was puzzled until he forced a book into my hands, a smeary bootleg paperback of The Quiet American, the 1955 novel that became famous for predicting the U.S. disaster in Vietnam before it had even begun. Grand Gri was Graham Greene. A few days later in Hanoi, I heard that Philip Noyce had just finished shooting part of The Quiet American there. I was surprised, for I wondered who would want to see it. But as we move toward war, the movie feels more relevant than it would have at any point in the last quarter century. You see, its title character, Alden Pyle, is a quintessentially American type, the likable do-gooder whose actions show how much damage can be done by those convinced they're on the side of the angels. The story is set in 1950s Vietnam, when Saigon was still Saigon. It focuses on Thomas Fowler, that's Michael Caine, an English reporter who wants little more than to live out his days with his mistress Phuong, played by lovely Do Thi Hai Yen, who can't act a lick. Suddenly, his romance is threatened by the arrival of Alden Pyle, played by cartoon handsome Brendan Fraser, a seemingly naive American optometrist who we gradually come to see in a very different way. As the two men battle for Phuong, Western artists love to portray Asia as a woman, it becomes clear that she embodies a bigger historical issue. And here, Pyle and Fowler have it out.
Tell me that you don't mean any of this. Tell me that you were only obeying orders. Or tell me that after what you saw in the square, those children who did nothing and hurt no one, tell me that you were so confused and horrified at how brutal and insane these actions are. Tell me how your love for Phuong has caused you to have some doubts.
But it is because of Phuong that I am even more determined. Let's just look at Phuong, this beauty. This daughter of a professor, taxi dancer, mistress of an older European man. Well, that pretty well describes the whole country, doesn't it? Look, Thomas, we are here to save Vietnam from all of that. What happened in the square today makes me sick. But in the long run, I'm going to save lives.
In a way, The Quiet American is a double act of restitution. First, for the original 1958 adaptation, which enraged Greene by flipping the story so that Pyle was the hero, not a villain. Second, for director Noyce, who's making his way back to serious filmmaking after years of doing Tom Clancy thrillers with Harrison Ford. Perhaps constrained by his regained earnestness, Noyce has produced a film that, for all its solidity, feels muffled and over-reverential. is professional, not passionate. I kept wishing it had more of Green's acrid intensity, which always preferred struggling sinners to the untroubled devout. Still, the movie holds us, thanks to the ravishing cinematography of Chris Doyle, who shoots Asia better than anyone on Earth, and the work of its two lead actors. Though a bit too grandfatherly for the part, Kane deserves his Oscar nomination, both for his magnificent voiceover and for an explosive scene at the U.S. Embassy, where Fowler rages like King Lear. If the underrated Frasier is less convincing as Pyle, this is because Pyle is an idea, not a man. Still, he makes us feel the queasy darkness lurking behind that square jaw and all-American smile. When I read Green's novel as a kid, I was awed by how worldly and wise it seemed. But watching Noyce's film, I felt what's trite about the story. In the character of Fowler, Green helped launch the tiresome cliché of the world-weary reporter who eventually discovers he must take sides, which is precisely what happens here. And Pyle, too, is a stereotype, the American innocent abroad of Henry James or Mark Twain, but now mutated into a villain whose villainy lies in his ignorant rectitude. He's the kind of guy who will destroy a village to save it. Green had no great love for America, and though he turned out to be prescient about Vietnam, the limitation of his novel, and of this movie, is its simplistic view of America's world-saving innocence. It seems blind to the possibility that there might be times, as in Kosovo, when Pyle's can-do naivete might prove far more humanly useful than the intelligent Fowler's jaded realism. In fact, I must admit that the quiet American inside me finds something seductive in the idea of saving Vietnam, saving Kosovo, and now saving Iraq. There's a certain romantic grandeur to the conception, the possibility of remaking a wounded country, if not the whole world, that stirs something deep and good in our national soul. But one of the great reasons to see the quiet American is to be reminded that, if we aren't careful, the admirable desire to save the world can be very dangerous to ourselves and to those we're trying to save.
John Powers is film critic and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harmony Books, a member of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of 10 Poems to Open Your Heart by Roger Houston. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The New Infidelity. We talk with psychologist Shirley Glass, who has studied extramarital affairs since the mid-70s. Also, Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy on interracial marriage. Join us for the next Fresh Air.